Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. That's Cannon, C-A-N-O-N. See what we did there. I'm Daniel Barnes, film critic, raconteur, gadfly, just all around wallaby. I ran out of words. And with me is my co-host, the great, hilarious, brilliant wallaby. Ran out of words again. Corky McDonald.
Dan, far be it from me to take away from you naming yourself after a marsupial. One of the things that you fail to mention in all these fantastic descriptors you do is hell of a host. Hell of a podcast host.
About you, you mean?
No, about you, sir.
Oh, about me.
About yourself. My. Gadfly, raconteur, man about town, hell of a host.
Hell of a host. Well, I didn't want to say it myself, and I certainly wasn't fishing.
Sure. If you say it, it sounds like bragging.
That you say it, though. I mean, I'm going to trust your expert opinion on this one.
Which is amazing, because you don't listen to podcasts and are actually unfamiliar with what it even is.
I'm pretty sure I have a kind of general grasp on it. It's essentially radio on the internet. I've gotten that far, and
joined 2004.
I'll go no further. Yes, absolutely. I think I get the basic concept of it. I don't need to go any further than that. I'm a first layer kind of guy.
Yes,
I get it right
don't
away.
Don't dig any deeper.
Right away. Why go any deeper if I understand it right away?
You turn off the Poseidon Adventure right when they go underwater.
I'm like, I'll be fine.
Yeah. This surface level, that's all I want.
No issues
Titanic,
whatsoever.
Halfway through.
Absolutely. Corky, before we get into the movie, you're famously known as a person with some strong opinions. Occasionally you'll get something stuck in that old craw of yours. Anything just really just chapping your hide these days that you want to get off your chest?
You want to know, Dan, here's another segment, what we like to call What Picks My Pocket. You want to know something that picks my pocket, Dan? Like almost literally, I had to rent a car the other day, right? So I drove up to Tahoe and had to rent a car.
Interesting.
The car rental company gives me a car and says, okay, well, we've got a quarter tank of gas in this car. Bring it back. Quarter tank. You know, great. Sometimes they give it to you full. Sometimes they give it to you half. This one was a quarter. So I don't know exactly how much driving I'm going to be doing. So I just fill it up. Now, if you return a car with less than what they gave it to you, they charge you to make it back up to that point.
Right. And it's exorbitant.
When you return it and it's got more than they gave it to you, you don't get a credit.
No.
You know they're going to make money off the next poor schlub who can't exactly meet the gas. And I think it's just a little picking my pocket.
Right.
To do
They're passing the buck from schlub to schlub to schlub.
Yes.
And you got
rents a car as a schlub.
Caught in the schlub fire is essentially what happened.
It's a peristaltic chain of schlub ripoffery.
Well, this has been another edition of
What's Picking My Pocket with Corky.
What's saltin' Corky's catsup? That actually sounds pretty good.
I know, right? I kind of like salt in the ketchup.
Yeah, salt in the ketchup. What's salt in Corky's chocolate?
What salts
cake?
My scab? That would not be good.
Oof. Ouch. All right. Well, we cobbled that intro together out of absolutely nothing.
Way Again, anybody who does not familiar with the show is like, what the hell is this show
What's
about?
Happening? And then
this is radio on the internet, and I've tuned into the wrong station.
People familiar with the show may not know what it's about. But, you know, in the words of, to paraphrase, the great Jennifer Lopez from Gigli, it's turkey time, cobble, cobble. Cobblin ain't just for old shoes anymore, Corky. Corky, are you popular in Afghanistan? Because you are like the king of Kabul.
Oh, man. Nice.
That's nothing. That's nothing.
No, you went to the well, but I liked it.
It's very deep in the hip bottom. There's a little sand in that one.
Yeah. No, see, you're only surface level. You didn't actually go look into the well. You just went to the well.
No, I just went to the well.
The concept of a well.
God only knows what's in the well. It's none of my business. Gorky, let's get to this week's episode.
Okay.
It was just a few episodes ago. We're on episode 11 now, but it was back in episode 8. We reviewed A Man Escaped by Robert Bresson, which we both loved. We both inducted it right away. Boop. Past the Smoot Hawley. No tariffs whatsoever. Right into the official cannon fodder. Cannon. Now, the random number generator gods have given us Pickpocket from the French Les Pickpocket. I didn't look it up.
As they say, Pickpocket.
Pickpocket. Which was Bresson's follow-up film to A Man Escaped. How perfect is that?
That's great. Amazing.
So Pickpocket, written and directed by Bresson, starring non-professional actor Martine LaSalle, amongst other non-professional actors, released December 16, 1959 in France. I'll give the IMDb synopsis. Michelle passes the time by picking pockets. It's right there in the title. Yeah. Careful to never be caught despite being watched by the police, his friend Jacques may suspect, while both men may have their eyes on Jean, the pretty neighbor of Michelle's ailing mother. Bresson, we talked about it in episode 8, A Man Escaped. He's only made 13 feature films in 40 years, but he has 5 movies on the Sight and Sound Top 250 that we're using to pull our movies from. This is the third highest of the 5 that are on the list. It's number 136 on the list. A Man Escaped was the second highest. Alhazard Balthazar, which is one of my favorites of his, is at number 25. That's the highest rated. I also mentioned in that episode our old buddy Paul Schrader. You remember old Paul Schrader, doggy dog Paul Schrader? He's written extensively about Bresson. Oh, Schrader's a shredder, all right, in that he's a giant rat. He's written extensively about Bresson for decades, and he wrote the book Transcendental Style in Film, Ozu Bresson Dreyer. And how funny is it that, like, we've done 11 episodes, we've had an Ozu, a Dreyer, and 2 Bressons. It's possible Paul Schrader is a random number generator god. He is very smart.
Oh, he's one of them. You know. What was our Ozu?
We haven't done an Ozu. I was thinking of Kurosawa. We'll get to Ozu, yeah. God willing. But Pickpocket, of all those Bresson films that Schrader loves, that is by far the most essential influence on his own work. Ending scene is echoed in many of Schrader's films. Pickpocket was written in 3 months and, according to Bresson, was, quote, shot in the midst of crowds in a minimal amount of time. Some classic Bressonian hallmarks: non-professional actors, real locations, lack of close-ups, aesthetic minimalism, which we all remember from A Man Escapes. So it, in many ways, feels like a companion piece to that film.
It does.
But it's also that film's mirror opposite, I think, in a lot of ways. Like, instead of the obvious hero doing obviously heroic things, escaping from a Nazi prison, here we get a complete blank, both of personality and of morality. Paul Schrader called him a soul in transit, kind of similar to Travis Bickle, a soul that can't find a place. Michelle, like, haunts the film. Like, it's not a great performance, but he has a very haunting sort of a presence. Both of these movies are process films, A Man Escaped and Pickpocket, but in Man Escaped, there's a point. There's a goal to the process. The goal here is very nebulous in Pickpocket. Michelle needs money, but it's a lot more than that. It almost made me think of The Assassins, how he kind of wants to be like the number one hitman on the hitman rankings. Like, he wants to be, he has a book called Prince of the Pickpockets. He wants to be Prince of the Pickpockets.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to be the best at his craft. So instead of this man, you know, in A Man Escaped, painstakingly working to gain freedom, in Pickpocket, he's sort of painstakingly working towards a cage instead of outside of a cage. He becomes increasingly isolated, alienated from people as he expands his career as a pickpocket. And it's only at the end, in the true physical isolation of prison, that he can find transcendence and actual freedom. Corky.
Yeah.
Of course, we'll get to that final scene. It's a very famous final scene. Even somewhat divisive final scene. But in an interview about the film, Bresson said that he would rather viewers feel a film before understanding it. That's his preference. Feel it before understanding. So before we talk about our understanding in a film, let me ask you, how do you feel about Le Pickpocket?
Pickpocket? I don't know what it is about this man's style of filmmaking, but it resonates with me so deeply. heartily. I find myself thinking about his movies long after they're done and enriching my enjoyment of them afterwards. So I'm all in. Pickpocket was fantastic.
You're feeling it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say that's exactly what I was thinking. I felt the film had an impact on me. The more I thought about it, I'm like, Oh, I see. And it made more and more sense to me. And it enriched my enjoyment of it.
Yeah. It's a very interesting movie. Right off of the bat, the first kind of title we say is that the style of this film is not that of a thriller. It's already saying, like, throw your expectations out, right? Like, it's somewhat frustrating in a way to viewers and to your expectations, because your expectations about this sort of a story, criminal, detective, and a girl.
Yeah.
You have these expectations, and they're constantly undermined. And it seems like scenes that are really key are left off screen, or they're sort of elided in a way. There's this whole two year period in Milan and Rome where he's like womanizing, gambling, and pickpocketing for 2 years. You're like, damn, that's a whole other.
Right? What's that movie like?
That's a whole other film, but it's not this movie. So it's just sort of handled in a diary entry.
My experience with Brisson is only A Man Escaped and this one. So. Mm-hmm. Two movies stripped down, like the minimal aesthetic, you know, no close-ups, he gets these people just to say lines over and over again to where they lose meaning. They're just ciphers delivering words. I think he calls them models, not actors.
Models.
So my experience and the way I would sum it up is that these are crime movies, not about the crime, more about the criminal, or only about the criminal. It's a study of the criminal who's involved in crime. So Tarantino made Reservoir Dogs, and it was a Japanese movie that he just did, like, fleshed out what happened when they left the actual action.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong. Hong Kong. Oh, sorry. Hong Kong movie. And then this movie is like what they make after Reservoir Dogs, like them dealing with life outside of that, right? that's a very loose and silly example, but it's a study of criminals, and both of them were trapped in prisons. The one thing I found about this that was so fascinating was Michel was trapped in a prison of his own making. Like you said, he moved towards a cage. He moved from a cage to a cage. His apartment is his prison. And the only difference is that he keeps his door always open.
Right.
But it's just a passage to his prison every time.
Yeah, it's a spiritual prison, you know. Or it's an emotional prison. He's constantly finding the pickpocketing completely alienates him from his mother, from his society, any romantic entanglements, from anything, and he can't. It doesn't actually make his life any better. He can't spend the money really,
because exactly.
Obviously everyone would know that it was him.
He wears the same schlubby suit the whole time.
Which is another connection to A Man Escaped, where he wears the same kind of blood-soaked shirt the whole time. Yeah, it's an excellent film. I think here's where it maybe falls a little bit short for me, and where a lot of the films that were so heavily influenced by this film, including some of Paul Schrader's films,
don't fail as much.
Yes, is in the character of Jean. Who is very much just sort of an icon or a symbol. I mean, they're all sort of icons and symbols, but she's just sort of there. There's nothing to her character at all, you know? Mm. And in the final scene, which we'll talk about, you know, it all kind of like comes rushing out, but she's just sort of there to be sort of symbolic.
Yeah.
Symbolically suffering. And so there's no richness to her character whatsoever. So that to me is, I think, where it does fall a little bit short, and where this movie, and I think just in its very nature, is just more like alienating and frustrating than Mouchette, Alhazar Balthazar, or Man Escaped, or some of the other films that have his life led, which I really do love this movie. I'm sort of on the fence of canonization, so hopefully over the course of the next 15, 20 minutes, you can sway me to it. So let's start at the beginning. First of all, we're seeing it's a diary. A diary is like a big something that Brisson goes back to over and over again.
And narration?
And the narration as well. Here we get both. And in Diary of a Country Priest, we get both. And right away, I think there's contradictions. So we have this first attempt at the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
As he's about to do it, you know, he's just sort of, he's there, he's amongst the people. There's not a lot of backstory of like, here's why he's doing it, here's why.
Again,
he needs the money, but that's not it.
That's why I quibble with Schrader saying that he's morally blank. I think he's amoral and also maybe has poor morals because he considers himself a Superman, the better than the rest. Society is bettered by what he does. And it's more of a compulsion for him. Mm-hmm. Like he does, like we said, he doesn't spend the money. He can't even, when he tries to explain it, he meanders and doesn't really convince anybody, but he has to do it at the detriment of his familial relations, romantic relations, friendly relations, his health. So at the detriment of everything, he's doing this. So yeah, I think he is a bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a conversation early on with a detective and with his friend where they kind of debate the ethics of theft.
Yeah.
The morality of theft. And he does give this kind of meandering and very self-righteous explanation about how great people are just above the law. And so if you're really great at pickpocketing, that's good for society because of reasons. I don't know. And the
detective he can't take it the next step. Did you get the Dostoevsky Crime and Punishment vibes? Like, this is Raskolnikov.
Yes, absolutely. Definitely a big influence on this movie.
Yeah, it begins, Raskolnikov opens Crime and Punishment. He's just talking about how he's fixated on killing this woman. And can he do it? That's it, right? This is less than that. He was just fixated on pickpocketing. We see him.
Yeah, can I just lift somebody's wallet and then walk right away? And this first attempt at the racetrack, where he's about to do it, the narration says, I should have left.
Right.
Right. Like right away, he just says, like, I should have left. And then after he takes it, he says, I was walking on air. And then immediately he's caught. So, but we don't actually see him getting caught. Instead, we see people advance on him and then he's in the car. So there's all these contradictions. There's things that are talked about, but not seen, seen, not talked about, talked about and seen. It's just very interesting, like the choices that he's making here.
Brisson?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why I kind of said it's a movie about criminals, not the crime, because it's not a lot of action. Although there is some fantastic edited sequences here of actual pickpocketing happening, but it's not action.
Crime. No, absolutely. Like, it's the pickpocketing we see is about patience, about precision, and it's about practice. Like there's a lot of practicing in here. He puts in his 10,000 hours for pickpocketing. Like he's pretty good at it. But yeah, as you say, it's about the isolation and the alienation of him and how as he gets better at it, he becomes more and more isolated, more and more alienated, more and more audacious, and more kind of alienated from morality as well as from other people. We're alienated from any sense of morality. Like it is very much like an addiction or a compulsion, like you were saying, because at the start he's able to rationalize it. He's able to even say to his friends sort of in a backhanded way, like I'm just, you know, there's a reason and this is actually good for society. And by the end, he doesn't really care. You know, he just wants to get better at it and better at it and do more and more and more and more and more.
The other contradiction is for all his talk of Superman and not needing to be, he's at his best when he's working with other pickpockets, but he can't accept that. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's true. It is about someone trying to just be the best at their craft in a weird sort of way and getting so obsessed with it that, you know, any kind of like meaning for it really kind of gets lost. He's constantly actually stealing other people's kind of ideas. The first guy, he just sees somebody else do it on a train. And he said, okay, well, I'll go home and now I'll practice this technique of folding a wallet into a newspaper. Then another, someone who initially seems sinister actually is another person who teaches him all the tricks that he knows and kind of brings him into this confederacy of criminals. But what's interesting is that the criminals, there's no like... they don't even talk to each other. No,
exactly. You
know, they sit down, they play cards, they steal stuff. They haggle over it at the end. That's the only time they talk to each other. It's like, here, I'll give you half, you give me half, here's this, here's that.
Nobody even seems to like get off on it. Like they just have to do it.
Yeah, that's true. There's no sense of joy. And you know, that's partly conveyed through, as you said, this sort of use of models instead of actors, this kind of theory of Bresson's. It not only did he not want, like, he said this interview, he said he didn't like any kind of emotion conveyed through face or voice or gesture. Yeah. Those are the ways you convey emotion. That's like, you don't other ways. Like I'm releasing pheromones right now to convey my fucking emotions. No, that's not how we do it.
Yeah.
Like it's through words and gestures and our facial expressions. So he really is kind of like drained it of that emotion. But at the same time, it is very emotional.
Absolutely. Well, and and one thing I noticed, it's like, I'm a sucker for music cues that spark emotion. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of Pavlovian sometimes with me. The music cues in this are not used that way. It's to kind of jolt you because it's so rare. And then they come in very either, they don't seem that germane to the scene for what the scene is, or it's very loud.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The use of sound also, the sound effects is very interesting and kind of helps build suspense. Sound of footsteps.
Sure.
Sounds, you know, the bustle of a train station, you know, all this kind of things that are going on around it, much like in A Man Escaped. But yeah, it's interesting, like the music, like you said, there's only a few musical passages. And when they do come in and then when they don't come in, like I said, the choices that are being made are all very evocative. Like this scene where he's practicing has this like montage kind of a feel. And it's like, wow, this is like the music just suddenly pops in the middle of this scene.
Yeah.
And it's this montage of them practicing things. But in the scene where they put it all into effect, this really amazing sequence at the train station where they're just stealing right and left, absolute silence except for, like I said, footsteps, the sound of train whistles, the sound of, you know, someone pushing a squeaky cart.
Or the ruffling through the stuff or sliding back into fabric.
Yes. Pretty fascinating how it's just like simple details that are used to build suspense and not necessarily music or people or facial expressions or anything like that.
One thing I did like about the way it's funny, he says he didn't want emotion being conveyed through eyes, through inflection, through the facial tics, was that he would always have Michelle look down. Like Michelle could not look anybody in the eye.
Yeah.
Or he's sitting opposed to his friend and the cop. Like they're never on the same side of the table. So it's always him against or him opposite or him not even be able, him sitting behind Jean. Like he can't look at her because I think it's because he knows his own, he's not a good guy. So he can't look at the good people.
Yeah. And you know, this is like our like instinct as viewers is to like, look at somebody's face and try to understand like, okay, well, what are you conveying? What's going on in your head, buddy? And usually actors are very generous and they give you that kind of information. And here, like we said, Bresson has worked studiously to kind of peel all of that away, of it away. It's just the unfinished wood there.
Right.
You know, there's no varnish left on this thing. There's no paint. There's no nothing. It's just there. It's just Paul Schrader just said like the looks on people's faces and their poses are like that of Byzantine art.
I was just thinking
that. It has this mercurial like look where they're kind of looking past you.
Yeah, they're beautifully sculpted and wonderful to look at, but there's nothing to the eyes.
Yeah, there's something really vacant and empty, and it's haunting. Like
yeah.
I said, really haunting. So, as we said, he meets up with another pickpocket. This guy, actually, I forget his name. He had like a one-word name, but he was a real pickpocket, and he really kind of helped train
cast
and helped work with Bresson. Yeah, this really kind of hound dog eyed man, this really like, you know, kind of droopy eyed man that he kind of goes to work with. So and as we said, there's no connection to them, no connection to any of these pickpocketing cronies. And you really kind of wonder, like, okay, well, what depths can he sink to? There's a scene where with Jacques visits his apartment.
And his best friend.
He finds this book, The Prince of Pickpockets. And he's kind of hanging up his Jacques jacket in his apartment and notices there's a billfold in there. And this is just as Jacques is saying, like, this guy wasn't so great. He stole from friends. Think that's right? And it's like, that was the literal, like, moral quandary that was just going on, like, right two shots before was, do I steal from my friend? Like, yeah. Is that where I'm at? Like, is that, because, like, that's considered really low. And a detail that we find out, like, really in the third act is that before any of this even started, Jacques stole from his own mother.
Michelle stole.
Michelle, sorry. The French people. Michelle stole from his own mother, who died shortly after, leaving Michelle distraught.
This is the other thing about this guy. He's not really fucking good at it. Like, Jacques knows. I decided this afterwards. Jacques knew that he was stealing from him. That's why he brought that up. Absolutely. His mom knew and chose to ignore it. He knew they both knew. And it was just, this is what I came to with this. He knew they both knew. And I was like, this, he knows he wants to go to prison. That's why he can't stop.
The detective knows. Even Jean knows, but she's so pure that she kind of denies it.
He has to tell her.
Yeah, he actually is like, hey, idiot.
Yes.
He calls her an idiot and says, figure it out.
You know,
like, and that just like absolutely devastates her to find out, oh, yeah, you really did do that. Yeah.
You know, and when Jean has a baby and he comes back and he's got everything to be on the straight and narrow for, he still can't fucking do it.
He can't do it. No, he's so easily tempted back into that. Yeah, it says Jean says, even before that, she says, you're not in the real world.
Yeah.
You know, he really isn't. He is just this kind of specter sort of haunting the world. And again, like going back to Paul Schrader, much like Travis Bickle in his cab, right? You know, he's part of the world, but he is not part of the world at all. He escapes to Milan. As we said, there's this kind of sequence that's just kind of alighted where he's gone for 2 years. He goes to Milan. He goes to Rome.
Goes to England.
Picks pockets all over Europe. Blows it all on gambling and women. And after 2 years, he's back in Paris. Once again, penniless.
Seriously, what, I guess, 45, 50 minutes we spent with Michelle before that would make you think that this guy would spend money on gambling and women? Like, this man enjoys nothing.
No, he is the most joyless person. He doesn't smile. He doesn't show any kind of any emotion or any kind of love or anything. He seems thoroughly cold to everyone that he meets. But here we are. You know,
and he's still wearing the same fucking suit for 2 years ago.
He's still wearing the same suit. Yeah, he was spooked to run because the detective.
Yeah.
Now again, the detective knew too. As you said, he's not that good because everyone knows, but kind of lets it go. He also gets caught several times. He gets caught the first time.
His pickpocket friends have to help him out.
Yes, he fucks up a thing in the bank where they have to come and save him. There's the guy who catches him and forces him to give back the wallet. He gets caught a lot. Yeah. You're absolutely right. But it's this detective who finally comes to his house and says, like, I know it's you. Doesn't arrest him. Doesn't tell him what he plans to do. And that is, like, more terrifying to Michelle than anything else, right? Like, as you said, he's been working towards that prison, right?
Yes.
Like, he's trying to get there. But the not knowing what anyone has in store for him is, like, more terrifying than anything else. Like, he's ultimately, this is, like, a control freak, you know, someone who cannot let go, who cannot, you know, let other people decide his fate for him. You know, he's so apart from everyone else. So that's the thing that really spooks him. He comes back and yes, as you said, he gets the straight job, says, let me try to do it. You know, let me try to be an honest man. And it's like the second day on the job, some guy has a paper open and just said, there's horse races day. You want to go? And yeah. That's as much as it takes. And it turns out that this guy who he thinks is a mark, thinks is a potential pickpocketing victim, well, he's actually an undercover cop, and away he goes. Set him up. His sort of Superman idea. He's more upset about compromising that. He's more upset that he fell for something so obvious.
Yes.
It's such an obvious ploy. Like, so this guy was just like flashing his money everywhere. Like, follow me here. Hey, look at all my money. Hey, I'm going to stand here and look really evilly at you.
Right.
As you're like trying to lift my wallet. He's more upset about that than being in prison, than being than failing Jean from anything else. He is lost, utterly.
Absolutely zero reflection on his own actions.
He says he's confessed, which he's, oh, great. Confession. That's good for the soul. And then he says, I'll recant it. Make it hard for them.
Right, I'm going to make it hard.
Like he even like something that seems like it's coming from a potentially virtuous, potentially self-nourishing sort of a place as confession. And remember, this is Brisson, Catholic director. Even that's just another trick by him. So it seems like he's done. But then we arrive at the famous final sequence. Corky, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so before I watched this, I did not know how heavily Paul Schrader was into him. And I know you've mentioned that book a few times, but I didn't know how heavily he was or how heavily he lifted this final scene for American Gigolo, for Light Sleeper. I think that's it. But one that really hearkened to me was Taxi Driver.
Mm.
Because I personally don't believe that Cybill Shepherd actually shows up at the end of Taxi Driver and just compliments Travis on his great job, and he's just looking at her. I had the same thing here. It's so out of tone with the rest of the movie. It's so ridiculous, and I didn't want that to be the ending of the movie. So I thought, and I kind of decided that this was he imagines this. Like, he imagines his salvation in her coming to see him. It ends with that letter where she's like, I'll come and see you. I can't right now, but I'll come and see you soon. Yeah. And that's him imagining it. And that's going to make everything better.
Yeah, that's an interesting reading on that. And yeah, certainly... It is very like out of tone because we've had this movie that has been so emotionally distant. It's constantly kind of pulling away from us. It seems like they've reached a point in this previous scene that we were talking about where she first goes to see him in prison. He has no contrition. He has no feeling. He doesn't care about anything except that he's compromised his status as Prince of the Pickpockets. And it seems like they've hit that point. Okay, that's it. He can't go any lower, and there's no possibility of redemption. He won't go for it. She won't go for it. And then, yeah, suddenly, she says, I'm going to visit. She visits.
Yeah.
And he says, like, her face just lit up. And suddenly, there's emotion. And the music, which is, we said, why is it in this sequence? Why is it not in this sequence? Why is it coming up here? The music comes in at the exact time that you expect music to come in a film. Like this, it swells as they come together, but then it also has this like very ironic, obvious like undercurrent, not even undercurrent, current, where he says at the end, oh Jean, to reach you at last, what a strange path I had to take. This is his narration. They're of course kissing through bars.
Right?
Like he has had to get to this point of actual, like, not just spiritual, moral, you know, ethical, personal isolation, but actual, like, physical isolation where he is completely has nothing left in order to finally reach some kind of, like, salvation or some kind of transcendence. So that, I think, is, like, it's a little fucked up. You know what I mean? But it's also just
dude.
It's also a very powerful, powerful moment in the film. But, yeah, it's a... How much stock can we put into it? And I think Brisson, you know, was trying to almost like kind of shock a little bit with that final sequence because it is very conventional and the entire rest of the film is extremely unconventional. It doesn't seem right.
Like the only time this man is in intimate proximity to anybody is when he's stealing from them.
And it is very
like hanging next to people. I did see somewhere where they said there's a homoerotic nature to a lot of the pickpocket scenes with hands reaching in, dipping in.
Gestures, and it's men
looking deep into each other's eyes.
Yes. Looking in each other's eyes, making gestures to follow or to come with. Yeah. It does absolutely have that feeling. That's a great point.
So, yeah, at the end now when he's, you know, having the Midnight Express, oh, Billy moment, oh, Jean, it was just like it was so far afield. But I could see it being an actual thing that actually happened in the reality of the movie. He's finally at the point where I'm being punished. And that's like what he's wanted this entire time. His mom didn't do it. His mom forgave and ignored. His friends forgave and ignored. The detective forgave and ignored. He's finally there, and he's like, all right, now I can be happy. It's so fucked up.
Right? Because he's finally in prison. And how does this help Jean at all? The single mother raising a baby by herself because she didn't love Jacques.
Right.
I mean, no one's really helped by this, except that he does find some like measure of like peace and love and transcendence. So, fascinating film. Favorite sequence? Do you have one?
Well, the pickpocket scenes are really amazing. The close-ups. I guess I would rather just talk about like what I saw from directors that I respect and whose work I admire. And another Scorsese kind of thing. Scorsese, like with the wall-to-wall narration, the edits over crime that make the crime look, without action, just look really interesting and appealing, like your favorite moments. So that's like heavy Goodfellas, Casino styles, that kind of stuff. Schrader, of course. I saw Travis Bickle all throughout this movie with this man.
Yeah.
Rebelling against society, thinking he's above, but he's really no great shakes compared to everybody else. Has the opportunity to do the right thing over and over and won't. You minimize the character, which I agree with. Jean is kind of a void. She's only there to be salvation or virginal, that kind of thing. But the actress and her performance reminded me of Kathy Moriarty in Raging Bull. Very young, but had this kind of look of being innocent and damaged at the same time.
Right. That's a great point.
Yeah, just fantastic. And maybe it's because it's black and white. It helped it out. And maybe knowing that their ages were about similar. God, I got such Kathy Moriarty Raging Bull vibes from her.
I love it. I will pick a favorite sequence. I think the train sequence. I mean, that's kind of an obvious one. But the train station sequence, which, as we said, is all kind of done just with, you know, sound effects, with the sound of the bustling train station, of the steps, of, you know, just little bits of fabric, fingers running across fabric and opening wallets and things like that. He says in the sequence, right before the sequence, he'd become increasingly audacious. He's working with a gang now. He's working with a group of pickpockets. They're at this train station. And it is this like really complex choreography of like passing things.
Yeah.
Taking something out, but then immediately passing it to someone, passing that to someone else. In some cases, actually somehow passing the empty wallet then back to the person.
In a train passageway, which is... It's not a roomy area. You are confined, closed quarters.
These are all people everywhere.
Yeah,
you're standing in line to buy tickets. There's people heading every which way. You're in the train. These are very, very kind of fraught circumstances. But they handle it just like a well-oiled machine. It's really amazing. Without again being so fussy, like trying to do it all in one shot or something like that,
because
that would be very un-Bressanian. He's sticking to his aesthetic principles and his ideas about, you know, sound and about image and composition, but in the sequence that is like really thrilling, and where there's so many different variations on how they steal and what they steal and when they steal and where they steal. It's a pretty fantastic sequence, and it's really sort of the pinnacle of where he gets to with his craft. This is as good as it gets. But as you said, it's heavily reliant on having three or four Confederates who are working in machine-like precision. It's on his own, he's garbage.
And how Bressonian is it to not have close-ups on anybody's face, but to have close-ups on thing, on objects, to show you like what's going to happen? I'm advancing the emotion through a thing happening, not in anybody's reaction or telling you what to feel. I think Richard Linklater called it the best edited sequence in film history, which I don't agree with, but that's a hell of a statement from a good director.
It's right up there. It's in the conversation. Let's at least say that. So, Corky, let's remind everybody about our rating system at the end of each review. Remember, we're going off of the British Film Institute's Sight and Sound Critics Poll of the top 250 greatest films ever made from the most recent poll in 2022. So at the end of each show, we decide, was that selection sound or was it a little slight? And if slight, what slighted movie would we put in its place? So, Corky, I put the question to you, pickpocket. Le slight or le sound?
Hark, you hear the cannons roar for me. Ooh. These are Napoleonic French cannons. Ba-boom, ba-boom. They are ringing loud and clear. Yeah, no, I would throw this one up there. I think I had a better affinity for Man Escaped, but I still admired this movie heavily.
Yeah, I said at the start of our review, I was on the fence. I prepared both ways. You know, like the candidate who prepares the victory speech and the concession speech. Well, some candidates prepare concession speech is or concede ever. So I prepared it both ways. You know what? Talking is sometimes, you know, you just chat and things reveal themselves to you. So I am going to light the fuse on my cannon too, sir.
Oh.
Kaboosh!
Baboosh, baboosh.
Brisson's got a twofer in right? Cannon fodder cannon. Who saw that coming? Anyone? No. Because he underestimated us again. Unbelievable. But yeah, in thinking about it, I agree. I don't put it on as high as A Man Escaped or a couple of the other ones I talked about. But what the hell? Great film's a great film. I'm not going to shit on Pickpocket just to glorify Man Escaped or glorify Man Escaped just to shit on Pickpocket.
Yeah. I really love that, you know, 5 years apart or similar, like 3 years apart, he made a movie about a man escaping prison and then a man forcing himself into prison, like doing everything he can just to get there. It's like, what was Bresson going through at that time? I know he was a prisoner of war at what time.
Oh, maybe. Right. Yeah. You know? So he's still dealing with some shit.
Ruminating on some shit.
Oh, yeah. But that was the 50s. I mean, those are his three films from the 50s, are Diary of a Country Priest, Man Escaped, and Pickpocket. He was in a dark place, man. But it only got darker. Don't you worry.
Till he made.
I did also prepare a slighted movie. I'll throw it out there just to give it some love. But a little movie from 1953 called Pick Up on South Street. It was one of the major inspirations for, not an influence on necessarily, inspiration for, at least the kind of general outline of the film, for Pickpocket. It's also the film's spiritual opposite. Of course, it was directed and co-written by Sam Fuller, starring Richard Widmark, Gene Peters, and Thelma Ritter. More of a film noir, a straight-up film noir kind of a take on it. While Bresson's film is very withdrawn and kind of frustrating, Fuller comes from more of a reporting background, specifically like a tabloid reporter background. So he kind of just, he yanks you into the story.
Yeah.
You know? And Fuller is one of my favorite directors. Go back to episode 4, our review of Bicycle Thieves. One of the best episodes we've done so far.
Absolutely.
I included Fuller's Shot Corridor in my list of the top 10 films. And this is another great one from him. I don't know. Yeah. I say they're different takes on the same story. We can love them both.
You can love them both. You're loud.
Bresson had a great interview. There was on the Criterion channel. You can see there's an episode of a French TV show where two film critics, I guess they're film critics or reporters, are interviewing them, Bresson. And he's like, you know, I like movies that don't necessarily, they're not my movies, you know, like they don't follow my like edicts, my style, the way that I make films, but I can still like them. So there's things he doesn't like, But it doesn't need to be, you know. So I think he can appreciate pickup on South Street. So why can't we?
It's got Widmark in it.
Well, that's a hell of a double feature.
You can't go wrong with fucking Richard Widmark in his noir bag.
Oh, and Thelma Ritter just slays it. I mean, if you know Thelma Ritter from Rear Window, I mean, she's absolutely outstanding in this film. Pickup on South Street and Pickpocket. Watch them both.
Hell yeah.
Order your choosing.
Okay, that's what we thought. We put it in our canon. Would you put it in your canon? What did you think? Did you think it was slight? Did you think it was sound? What do you think about what we thought? What do you think about what we thought about what you're thinking about us? Huh? Tell me what you think about riff on rental cars. I want to know. If we get enough, if we get a voting block, we can overtake these people. Anyway, we'd love to hear your take. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Danger Pod and tell us what you're thinking about it. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to see if we can go 3 for 3 with Brisson. A heat check, if you will.
Okay, yeah. We're at the logo. We right? just stepped across half court. It's just like, all
Brisson's
right.
like, he's like, on, I'm on fire, like double dribble. Like, he is flaming right now. So he's like, boys, I don't care. Just toss it up. Walking off Larry Bird, finger up.
On the shot clock. Yeah, he's feeling it. So this, of course, is the part of the show where we select the film we'll review on our next episode in 2 weeks. Of course, we sacrifice any number of livestock to the random number generator. Guys, I don't want to describe all of the livestock.
No, yeah, it's St. Patrick's Day. One of them's corn, though.
The beef has been
You know what? Corn's my beef.
Classic segment. So I'm going to hit the random number generator button. We've got a Letterboxd list. It's all numbered. It's the Sight and Sound top 250 movies that we haven't reviewed yet. So let's just hit the button.
Okay.
What do you got for us, gods? Oh, shit. The gods are loving the Dublin because we, Quirky, are heading back to the Boone Well.
Wow.
It's the Louis Boone Well. Remember episode 3, we watched El Angel Exterminador, a.k.a. The Exterminating
Angel. We canonized it.
We were split on that one. Actually, no, we were split on that one, weren't we?
No, we canonized it.
Did we?
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and look at that. Well, whatever. More Boone Well, baby. The Young and the Damned. It's Los Olvidados. This is from his Mexican phase. This is another film. This is like the beginning of his Mexican phase. Exterminating an Angel was at the tail end there. Let me read you the synopsis to The Young and the Damned, Los Olvidados, from 1950. A group of juvenile delinquents lives a criminal, violent life in the festering slums of Mexico City. Among them, the young Pedro, whose morality is gradually corrupted and destroyed by the others. I have never seen this film. I love Boone Well. I'm very excited to see it. From what I understand, it's much more in a realistic vein than El Angel Exterminador, which is a surrealist comedy, satire, drama, thriller, horror film, whatever you want to call it. Los Olvidados, I think, is a little more of a neorealist type of movie. At least that's my understanding of it. And we'll find out next week. It's only 82 minutes.
Oh,
Quirky.
Right up my alley.
Right? And hey, by the way, if you're considering, you're on the fence about watching Pickpocket, it's a lean 76, yeah. Baby. It might be 75.
There are documentaries about Pickpocket that are longer than Pickpocket.
That is very true. So, yeah, it might be worth your time. Pickpocket is, of course, available on
Criterion
channel. Young and the Damned, I believe we are going to need to rent this thing or find it on YouTube somewhere. We'll figure it out and we'll get back to you. But Young and the Damned, I'm pretty sure it's available on YouTube to watch for free. So
okay.
Check it out there. And that's all we have for you on this week's show. Join us in 2 weeks when we will review Los Olvidados. Like I said, it's out there somewhere. Go find it.
In the meantime, follow us on Facebook and Instagram for updates on this show and any upcoming episodes of the Dear Daniel podcast. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. Please share us. Tell a friend to listen to us. Tell your mom to listen to us. If you're interested in donating to the show, go to daredaniel.com. Click that donate button or find support the show in the menu. For Canada Fodder, I am not Dan. I'm Quirky. I'm tired of saying it.
Yeah, and I'm Jacques, Michelle, Daniel Barnes. And until next time, Ozu, the Kurosawa, save us a seat.
Japan, Hong Kong.
The back row.